Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Module 4, Part 2, with Elise on behalf of the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. Usual question, how are you going, magic students?
Fine.
Pretty good.
Really good.
All right, well, it's good to hear. Well, we're having a quiet week this week because we sort of dawdled our way through the ISPs last week, and then we got into the cables. Cables are wonderful things. We need them because without them, we have no network. So we're going to continue the part on cables, which is why I said it's part four. It's chapter four, part two. I was hoping to throw the discussion open and probably will do so to a limited extent afterwards for discussion on ISPs. I actually wanted to sort of set some exercises on how to calculate download times, that sort of stuff. I wanted to sort of show you some interesting things on the internet. Regrettably, I'm not feeling too good today, plus my business has been demanding my attention during the week. Take it a bit easier, I think, and if we do 2 hours, we do 2 hours. If we don't, we don't. And I think that's pretty good because as of next week, you'll be halfway through the course, and at that same point, it ramps up with all that binary and mathematical stuff that we've got to do. IP addressing is a fascinating part of the curriculum. It's one of the things I enjoy, and I think we need to be on top of the world for that. So that's what we'll do. Most of you now have done everything required of you for Chapter 4. I've seen some people coming in saying that they've listened to those recordings and submitted kindly the lab that is required, which is the ping and trace route lab. I've seen a couple of those come in, so thanks for that. So that's been all good. That's the only that trace route command that you have to do. The rest of it's all making of cables, and my suggestion was to read Kylie's cable making expose, and thank you to Kylie for making that available. There are the older recordings, and I think I sent all this out by email during the week, of the old CCNA days when they were making some cables and testing them. Whilst it's all very fascinating, they are a bit tricky to listen to, regrettably, and if you want to listen to them, I'd suggest you do, but if you find them tricky to listen to because of background noise and the fact that the thing wasn't produced, it was a sort of willy-nilly, you know, what's going to happen next type thing, I fully understand
that
you can't get through it.
I know what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I think if you're going to do these things, you need to produce them a bit, and it makes it all go a lot better, but there again, I'm a Toastmaster, and I'm used to working with in more of a production environment when it comes to presentations, so there it is. But yep, if you can get through it, please do. We tried, Ian. We really did try. Okay. All right. Here comes Marshall. How you going, Marshall?
Okay, I guess.
All right. You weren't here with us last week. We didn't get all the way through Chapter 4. And I was just saying to people I had wanted to finish off the cables, which is what we're going to do. And then we're going to have an open discussion on internet connectivity. We did a lot on that last week. I haven't been feeling too good. So if we stay the 2 hours, we stay the 2 hours. If not, we don't. So this is sort of a bit of a warm-down session before the hard slog of Chapter 5. Chapter 5 being the addressing chapter. How does that sit with you?
Fine with me. I'm still back on Chapter 3. I hit the exam and bounced.
Okay, well, we can go through some things if you like. It's a pretty tricky exam. It does take a lot of study to do that one. All right, the lecture will continue at 2100 hours GMT next Thursday. For those people who are calculating against you, GMT, calculate it to your local time zones. Okay, thanks.
No problem.
Great. All right, let me go back to my lesson plan and we'll get started. Well, last week we did all up to 4.4.4, and we were discussing our internet service providers. We were talking about the NOC, or the Network Operations Center, and POPs, and a lot of other acronyms I don't hear outside of the context of this course. We were talking about how you connect to different ISPs. We did a lot of discussion on the the types of connections, for example, cables. We did discussion on cable internet connection, and we did discussion on ADSL, or asymmetric digital subscriber line. We talked about dial-up and wireless for a little bit too. We talked about the types of connections that may or may not be available in your area. We also talked about the costs, what you get for your money, and what some of the, and then it also includes the type of service you get. For example, do you get the good telephone support, or do you even need good telephone support? So we talked a lot about internet service providers. This chapter then proceeded to take us into cables. We talked about UDP. Does anyone remember what UDP is?
Unshielded
Are you confusing
twisted
that?
Pair.
Are you confusing that with user datagram protocol?
UTP, you are so right, Paul. Like, as I said, I'm not feeling well. You are, UTP, sorry, unshielded twisted pair, UDP, yeah, user datagram protocol. Why don't you take over the class, Paul? Let's kick back.
Oh!
Good one, hey? UTP, I mean, is as near as I was about to say, is unshielded twisted pair. Coax, we talked about coax. We also talked about shielded twisted pair. And I'm going to keep the acronyms out of it today because I can't be bothered. All right. I know many of you have listened to the cable making labs. I've at least read Kylie's worksheets, which has all been good. So we're a little bit aware. Pat did have some questions, which I'll address a bit later on. And I think some of those questions may be addressed in the next section. All right. Okay, we stopped at we did all the discussion on those copper cables being unshielded twisted pair and shielded twisted pair and even coax. The next part of the curriculum takes us into fiber optic. In the home and small business environment, we really won't see much of it. I'm not even sure why it's covered to the point that it is in the course. There are some exam questions on it, however, so let's go through that part of the curriculum. With fiber optic cables, they have quite a high bandwidth, which enables them to carry large amounts of data at any one time. Fiber optic cable is used in backbone networks, enterprise networks, and wherever there's the need to move lots of data around, so large data centres. We also see it between the telephone exchanges here in Australia. Oh, there it goes. And then I anticipated the next paragraph. It is also used extensively by telephone companies. And fiber optic cable can be made of either glass or plastic with a diameter of something about the same as a human hair. So for all those people with lots of hair out there, think of it, well, there you go, that could be fiber optic cable if you're a robot. The advantages of this sort of cabling, of course, is it carries very high-speed data over very long distances with no loss or minimal loss, as opposed to the copper counterpart. Since this type of cable uses light pulses instead of electricity, this type of cable is not susceptible to EMI. And what is EMI?
Electromagnetic interference.
Electromagnetic interference.
Thanks, Narissa. Thanks, Paul. Fiber optic cable is used in other instances like medical imaging, medical treatment, and mechanical engineering inspection. The copper, their copper counterparts. Why does this thing go on about it? Look, I'm going to skip it. Well, it does it. Sorry, Cisco. I'm skipping about 50 lines here because it's probably all repetitive. All right. Fiber optic backbones are found in many organizations and are used to connect ISPs on the internet. So let's talk about the link between Narissa and I, because even though we're in the same city, she's on Optus, I'm on TPG. There's probably some fiber optic between the two internet service providers. I don't know it's that for sure, but there probably will be. Okay, each fiber optic circuit is actually two fiber optic cables. One is used to transmit data and the other is used to receive data. Okay, now there's something here in the notes about the composition of the fiber optic cable. Okay, and let's see if I can get this right and it makes sense to you guys. Okay, there's the jacket of the fiber optic cable used to protect the whole cable from abrasions and solvents and anything else that's nasty out there and other contaminants, it says. In other words, it's at the outside of the wire. This outer jacket outer jacket composition can vary depending on the cable usage. So it can be made out of a number of different things, I guess. I'm no expert on cables, by the way, so please don't ask me too many questions about it. There's a strengthening material that surrounds the buffer of the cable. This prevents the fibre cable from being stretched when it is being pulled. That material is the same material used when making bulletproof vests. So there you go. It's some magic stuff. There's also a buffer in the cable to help shield the core of the cable from damage, and there is some cladding which is made from slightly different chemicals from those used in the core. Yeah, I don't like the way this is worded. Who even marked this stuff up? Okay, now this cladding, and I think I saw an exam question about it once. I know there was some discussion on it. Can actually act like a mirror.
I think there is a mention of it.
Yeah, all right. So, like, get ready for a test alert about the cladding. So in my way of reckoning, without seeing a fibre optic cable in person for a long time, if ever at all, the cladding is the nearest part to the core of the cable. So this cladding may affect the light that goes through it and cause a little bit of reflection. Are you following all this, Kim?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, it's a bit dry and boring, isn't it? Yeah, as if we really need to be installing fibre optic cable across the living room. But it's in the curriculum, so we've got to cover it. Oh, here we go. It says that actually the cladding can act like a mirror, reflecting light back into the cable. This keeps light in the core as it travels down the fibre. Now, the core of the cable is the light transmission element, the centre of the optical fibre. It's the bit that has the light in it. I don't know whether anyone ever saw those lamps that were all the rage in the early 80s. You have a little light at the light box at the bottom of the thing, and you'd have it changing colours, and you'd have these nice little fanny things that would come out.
Tiffany and I were talking about whether that's what fibre optic is, because I've got a fibre optic
yep.
Christmas tree, just a little one.
Oh, I've seen them
too.
They're good.
That would be the same as what's in the middle of the cable, would it?
Yeah, pretty much. And you put a light source at the bottom, right? So what happens is you can bend this fibre optic and you see the little point of light at the end of it.
Yeah, that's what my Christmas tree's like.
There you go, yep. So, you know, imagine that, and obviously the Christmas tree isn't shielded, so, you know, light could get out and you could get some losses. But if you had that in a properly suited cable, as I've just mentioned, you could transmit that for kilometres. There is a thing here that says
it
suggests...
Beautiful stuff.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? So you imagine light flickering off and on all the time. Being a series of offs and ons, binary or something, then yeah, that's how it works, basically. So think of your Christmas tree. It says here this core is typically silica or glass. Your mum had one, actually, Narissa. I don't know what ever happened to it. It fell to bits, I think. That was back in the early 80s. But, yeah, I've seen Christmas trees. And they look nicer now, too, because I think they're probably using LEDs and light-emitting diodes in the light box, too, so they have a better sort of nicer light about them. It says here, light. So for the people who aren't used to seeing things, these things are usually pretty colours, which is probably why Narissa loves it. We haven't really gotten that much further along the line since I was 4 years old, have we? So we love our colours. Anyway, it says here, light pulses travel through the fibre core. And there are actually two forms of fibre optic cable, and I think there is some test alert business coming up here, so let's have a look. There's multi-mode and single mode. Let's explore the difference. With multimode, multimode is the less expensive and more widely used. I guess anything that's less expensive would be more widely used. The light sources that produces the pulses of light is usually in LEDs or LEDs. It is referred to as multimode because there are actually multiple rays of light. So you have multiple rays of light transmitting multiple bits of data through the cable, as Jaws says here, simultaneously. Each ray of light takes a separate path through the core. Multimode cables are usually suitable for links up to 2,000 kilometres. No, sorry, that's wrong, 2,000 metres. That's 2 kilometres. Yeah, 2 kilometres. So there you go, we could chuck one here from my place to Mount Waverley Village, or my place to Vicky's house. There you go. However, so it's 2,000 metres, guys, if there's a test on it anyway. However, improvements to technology are making this better. Yay. Now, what's this down... Okay, it's talking about, I don't know why it's got standard PVC coating here. I don't know who wrote these notes. I didn't. there's some glass cladding here that's 125 microns in diameter. The glass core, which is really what we're interested in, is between 50 or 62.5 microns in diameter. That's really small. You can get multiple paths of light to travel through this junk. I'm trying to quantify this into sort of something you're like, going to understand. I think they're supposed to be bullet points that have gone severely wrong. Okay. Well, basically, it just talks here about the different thickness of cables with LEDs, and it's, you know, I think they're more likely trying to talk about the advantages of using the multi-mode cable. So basically, the key thing you got to remember is it's for distances of a few hundred metres, with LEDs, etc. You might find that these are used for a few hundred metres within a campus network, so say a hospital or a university or something might have these linking different parts of the campus. Any questions at this point? Evidently not. Good. Single mode fibre optic cables are constructed in such a way that light can follow only a single path through the fibre. One, so single mode, it's pretty self-explanatory. Single mode means single path through fibre. Okay, the light source for a fiber optic cable is usually a LED laser, not just a LED, but a laser, which is significantly more expensive and intense than standard LEDs. It's more of a coherent light. Due to the intensity of the laser, more higher data rates and intensity, because of the intensity, basically we can have longer ranges of cable and we can get through more data on this thing. Okay, single mode fiber cable can transmit data for approximately 3,000 meters and are used for the backbone cabling of various systems, including network operation centers or NOCs. Again, improvements of technology is significantly improving these figures. This has a polymeric coating, interesting word. Okay, the glass cladding is again 125 microns in diameter, and the glass core is only 9 microns in diameter. Single straight through path for light is one of the bullet points here that aren't really bullet points and making it increasingly difficult to read. Has a small core, less dispersion, so the light's sort of not being dispersed, suited for long distance applications, and uses laser, as I've already said, for the light source. Okay, commonly used on backbone on campuses for distances of several thousand meters. And there you go. That's a little bit there on fiber optic. I hope it all made sense. I hope it did. I really, truly do, because there's probably some exam questions. There are some exam questions. Any questions, gang?
Not at this point.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, guys. 4.5.1 cabling standards. Now, this is important, and this has more bearing on what we do here in the home office and small office environment. And it's 8:34 a.m. if you're in Melbourne. Cable is an intricate part of building any network. Duh. Let's cursor down to something we don't know. Okay, cabling standards here are a set of specifications for the installation of cables. This is interesting. Standards specify types of cables to be used in specific environments. They talk about conductors, material, pinouts, etc. Connector types and performance limits. So there you go. These are the things I've just mentioned are all included in the standards. There are many different organisations involved in the creation of standards. Some of these organisations only have local jurisdictions, others don't. Let me see, we've got some various cabling standards coming up, gang. North America. They have the Canadian Standards Association, SCA. We have the IEEE. We've always talked about a lot about the IEEE here in Cavi. There's another crowd here called ANCI/TIA/ETA, whoever they are. South America has another mob, same mob, this ANSI, I've just mentioned. Europe has the ITU, which is the International Telecommunication Union. Okay, what else we got? British standards. We have the CEN/Centrelink. Asia has National Quality and Bureau. This is all going to go over your head, and it's not an exam, bugger it.
No, it's definitely not an exam.
Screw it. I'm going to say, yeah, all right, so the Japanese have got their own standards. Even the Aussies are mentioned here. There you go, we've all got our own standards. Let's hope we can actually talk to each other. Didn't we just say somewhere in the curriculum that we'd actually like to have standards so we can all talk to each other? And now we've got all these different countries who have got organisations anyway. Australia has some mob called the AS/NZS/ACA. Oh, that'd be the Australian. What's the ACA stand for, Marissa? Do you know?
No.
Australian Communications Authority, I think. Something like that. Geez, I don't know. And I'm supposed to be a student of politics. Good grief. Okay, with Ethernet used worldwide, it was prudent to investigate using structured cable is the infrastructure for delivering power over Ethernet. Power over Ethernet, I think, is what Kylie often is getting a bit interested in at times. In 1999, the IEEE began developing the standard for delivering power over Ethernet. Aha, power over Ethernet, how about that? Today, this standard is known as IEEE 802.3AF-2003. Get a life. It is used to send 48 volts DC along with Ethernet data along four pair of UTP or STP cable. Why do we want 48 volts? I'm not sure why yet. PoE, or power over Ethernet, and it's important, this is actually written as capital P, little o, and capital E, incidentally. Power over Ethernet allows network engineers to have flexibility in the placement of endpoint devices such as wireless access points, video cameras, IP telephones. Basically, it says here because there's no need to have an electrical outlet near the device. Okay, any questions before the next bit?
If all the standards are different, I don't understand how they physically connect countries to the internet. Like, does the cable go under the sea, and how does it connect if their standards are all different? Or like, how would we connect?
Yeah, no,
connect,
that's right. You don't. No, you do. Well, firstly, Ethernet is standard, as we've learnt from other lessons. Ethernet is quite standard. It's been developed, in consultation with the IEEE, etc. These other
but
organisations.
What are you talking about with these other organisations? I
don't really know what they do. I think they just maintain the standards. I don't know how much of the standards they develop, because I mean, so let's be honest. If I took when I go to Canada, if I take my modem there, for example, I may need to adjust the modulation to comply with the North American standards when I use it on the ADSL system over there. I may or may not. I'll have to check with Craig on that one. So there are sort of variations in, like Ethernet's the same, but sometimes a good case in point, for example, FM radio, for example, they use a different de-emphasis and emphasis on the treble in North America than we do in Australia. So if we take our transistor radios over there, they might sound more tinny. But they'll
the other the other factor is history. As various countries came online, they each had their own history, which is why the United States has such a poor cellular phone system as compared to Europe.
Absolutely.
These organizations do more than just provide standards for the internet. They provide standards for radio broadcasts and other things. But they can also use the same standard, because the standard is just a piece of paper, really.
Yeah. So another good case in point, Narissa, is you know how our AM radio stations, for example, all end on a lot, 1278, Magic 1278 in Melbourne, 693, 3AW, 774, ABC, et cetera, and whatever it is. Yeah, and that's because we're using a 9 kilohertz step between our stations, so they all have to end in a multiple of 9. In America and Canada, it's still 10. And we made that change back in the 1970s, actually. So anyone who's got a channelized digital receiver on AM here, and they took it to America, apart from the any other issues, wouldn't hit the stations properly unless there's a switch on the back to change it.
And can someone explain to me, how do they actually physically connect the cable? Like, do they lay it under the sea, or what?
Yep, they lay it under the sea. And as Kylie mentioned, the cable that mainly connects Australia and New Zealand is the Southern Cross cable. And if it breaks, we're going to be a bit screwed. I would like to think that there's other ways through Southeast Asia and Europe. In actual fact, I think if you do a trace route from here, that's where my traffic goes around via anyway. Because I'm on a Tier 1 ISP, I think, which is TPG, and Telstra and Optus are also Tier 1 ISPs. We're using the... apparently, I don't know a great deal about this. Kylie seems to have studied it a bit more, and her suggestion is we're using the Southern Cross cable, which links us to, I think, America. And soon we're going to have the Pacific cable coming on board. So they are cables under the sea. I don't know how much of this stuff goes around via satellite, so I would hate to think that any earth tremors in the Pacific, for example, might break the cable.
I might have a chat to Kylie about it one day. It's interesting, like wondering how they actually do it.
Yeah, well, they've laid this...
They just run it up offshore. They probably put it in a metal conduit for the first couple of kilometers so people can't cut it, and then it runs into a building, and from that point it starts spreading out. And the only reason I know that is I was reading a book about spies, and they started out with the place in California, which I think is near San Diego. And then they spread it out into the fiber backbone here.
They'd have to put it pretty low under the sea so that shipping, wouldn't cut it or whatever.
The sea's pretty deep.
So they'd have some sort of means of getting it really low, I suppose, like some sort of cable-laying ship or something?
Yeah, they actually have special ships that do it. The other thing is they really do want it resting on the ground. They don't want it suspended across canyons and such not. So it actually goes all the way down to the bottom of the sea, although I'm not sure it goes across things like the Challenger Deep, which is 6 miles deep. It probably doesn't follow a straight line. It probably has all kinds of curves in it.
That's pretty amazing to think that a ship can lay it so deep that, you know, the rest of the shipping doesn't interfere with it.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose gravity pulls it down. I don't know much about overseas cabling at all.
It's also armored. It's not like the cable you see in your going from your computer to your wall. It's actually armored and it's fairly thick. It's probably an inch in diameter or more because they also have to have repeaters. That's where the power over Ethernet comes in. You know, they can't just send it. The signal just can't go straight from the United States to Australia in one hop. It has to be amplified and some other electronic magic done to it every so often.
Well, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if it's copper or fiber optic.
Kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it's scary. You know, when I went to see Jackie last year, it was this, from Sydney to Los Angeles, it was, 13 hours? Plus the hop from Melbourne to Sydney and hop from Los Angeles to Phoenix. When I go and see Accumulator this year, it's going to be that plus another 4-hour flight. So, you know, you sort of talk on Skype here and apart from a little bit of latency, you're within a second of hearing the other person's voice still. And it's just scary that to actually get physically there, you've got to spend so much time travelling.
And we take it all for granted, but amazing to think some sort of ship has laid it all that way across.
Yeah, well, see, that cable's not only just looking after our traffic, it's also looking after telephony as well, you know, telephones and things.
And it doesn't go all the way. For example, it probably goes from, the west coast of the United States to either Hawaii or Midway or Guam, one of those places, and then to other islands. And they do break. Wasn't it Africa that lost their communications cables a few years ago because something happened to the cabling on the floor of the ocean?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. That would be quite devastating.
I hate to be the technician, have to go down there and fix that.
Yeah.
Just imagine it.
Well, they actually can go down and snare the cable and bring it back up again and repair it.
Well, they don't take too long to do it. Yeah, it's crazy. All right, well, it's just not like ringing up the local technician or, having them call, is it?
No, it's slightly different.
Absolutely.
They're all robots.
Yeah, probably. All right, back to UTP cables. Okay. Now, we've got some standards here, T568 and T560B, which are two standards. Were they mentioned in the test, Narissa? Because actually, Narissa's done the test, so she can tell us.
There was a diagram where you had to identify the cable.
Yes, there were two diagrams. I looked at the exam today, and I thought I actually had the picture descriptions here, but I don't. I've got the quiz picture descriptions and the module picture descriptions. I don't have I'll have to get up on QCAT and get them.
I've got the exam descriptions because I looked at them before I did the exam.
Were they helpful?
No, I don't think so, because one of them said something about two cables connected by SC connectors, and I didn't know what that was, and I Googled it, and every time I typed in SC connector, it took me to a page about fiber optics, so I assume it's some sort of connector that connects fiber optic cables. And there was a picture of fibre optic cables.
Okay. Because there's a picture there. Refer to the exam. Look, I'm going to tell people, bugger it. There's one, it's just getting the right question for the right exam description, which is another one of my beefs. Don't get me started on these picture descriptions, for God's sake. One is what type, refer to the exhibit, look at the picture and tell us what cable it is, and it is a UTP cable. The ends thereof. And the other one is refer to the exhibit, tell us what type of cable it is, and is a fibre optic cable. And there is a picture there that shows you a rollover cable, which we'll come to in a minute, and you have to tell it that I think it's a rollover cable. Hang on, I'll check on that. And I don't mind giving those.
I don't think rollover cable was the answer because I don't remember putting that.
Hang on, here it is. It's, well, it probably wasn't. Hang on, let's have a look. Refer to the graphic. What type of cable is shown? And it for me, and I don't even know how they'd quantify this in a picture description. They're actually talking about a...
I don't remember that one.
It's got pictures of what I thought was a connector with the coloured wires in it. Sorry. You obviously got it right, Nerys, because that's not the question we were discussing on that.
I can't think of that one at all.
He says... Oh, 2 points for option one. It's a crossover. Oh, okay. Yeah, they're showing you a crossover cable, basically. Answer crossover, and you got that question right there. I gave you the answer. The question shouldn't do that in the course, but look, bugger it. You know, if we're doing picture descriptions, it should probably, you know, it's just a pain. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, they're talking.
Well,
when
people are totally
cable.
Blind and they can't see the pictures, I think you've got every right to tell them, because I think, you know, having to guess isn't fair, because then if... but with the pass mark being 75, you've only got to have 3 wrong guesses and then a few others wrong and you've failed, and that's not fair.
No, I agree.
I agree with y'all on that, because that's why I ended up failing Cisco 1 to begin with my instructor.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I haven't looked at the picture descriptions for this, so I can't comment, but some I have looked at, I've been a bit, okay, I went through some of the IT ones with Kylie when that started, I'm going, yeah, all right, well, I suppose... There is a fine line if you're doing a picture description as to how much of it you can give away. I don't relish being the people who have to write some of these picture descriptions, because there's always a fine line. My solution to the thing is that you would actually... My biggest beef with the picture descriptions is usually the fact that you've got to have another document to which to alt tab to, and the picture descriptions are obviously, you know, often not in order. I have a problem with that, because I think the exams are usually more ordered than people give them credit for. If it's going to be question 14 in the exam, it generally is. So, yeah, it means that you've got to flurry through the descriptions and find the right one, and hope for the best you're actually looking at the right picture descriptions. It does detract from the learning process, yes. All right, there's the Elise Lonsdale editorial for today. I wonder how much trouble I'll get in for saying all of that, but there you go.
Well, it puts totally blind people at a great disadvantage,
well, it puts
tonight,
people
so I agree with you. Why not tell them?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, it flies in the face of web accessibility standards too. If you want to put a picture on a web page, bloody will describe it. All right, okay, back to the curriculum. The standards T56A and T56B, now they're talking about swapping the Ys. Now this is important, because we start talking about the crossover and rollover cables and straight through cables here. Okay, let's see if I can put this into words. I do advocate people read their notes at this point, because I may not be able to express it so well. Okay, yeah, basically says with T56A, and it gives green / white, pair, which is pair 3, to pair. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to quantify this very well, so I'm going to ask people to slowly read their notes. You're probably not going to remember it too well anyway, and you're probably not even going to remember the colours so well. But basically, in a connector for a RJ45, we have 4 pairs of wires, and we usually have 2 greens, 2 oranges, 2 blues, and 2 browns. Okay, and sometimes, and we swap pin 3, which is the orange-white one, with pin 1. Now, I get this all mixed up myself, to be blunt. I really do. Usually, there's 2 of each colour, and to separate the 2 of each colours, you'll see that there's a green cable and there's also an equivalent white cable with a green line on it. Same as with the blue part of the cable, pins 4 and 5 are blue. Pin 5 will normally be a white cable with a blue line on it, etc. So that's why they're talking about it in bunches, in pairs.
One thing that I remember...
6 can be swapped, actually, in a crossover. Sorry?
I was just going to say, one thing that I found helpful was to remember that the 2 that start with B don't change. And
yep.
You know that... do any of you know that Irish Rovers song, The Orange and the Green? I sort
of
course. Remembered that the orange and the green
yeah.
are the ones that do swap.
And they're the ones that fight.
Ones don't.
And you swap them round. Yeah, I love it. Oh, ripping, Nerissa. So the brown and the blue, the ones that begin with B, which is 4, 5, and 7 and 8 don't change. But the ones, the orange and the green do, yeah, exactly. Pin 1 can be swapped with pin 3. I'm just looking at the diagram here. Pin 2 and 6 can be swapped, and pin 3 and 1, as I said, can be swapped. So that gives you a crossover cable, and that's to enable the transmit pins on one end of the cable to be connected with the receive pins on the other end of the cable. So we're swapping And I'm just going to make sure I get this right for you guys. We're swapping 1 and 3 and 2 and 6. Yeah, 1 and 3 and 2 and 6. So, we will often talk about straight through cables and crossover cables. Okay, now, the straight through cable is the most common type because it maps the pins on one end of the cable to the pins on the other end of the cable. For example, the wire on pin 2 will always end up at the wire at pin 2 on the other end of the cable. It won't swap with anything, with 6 or anything. It will just go straight through. Pin 1 will be mapped to pin 1 and pin 3 will be mapped to pin 3 and so on. So in other words, if T56A is on one end of the cable, for a straight through cable to exist, we have to have standard T56A on the other end of the cable. If the standard of T5, on the straight through cable, if T568B is on one end of the cable, we find the standard will be also 568B on the other end of the cable. Okay. Now, this also means we can plug into unlike devices, and that means a host with a switch or a host with a router. So they are unlike devices. I have a feeling there's some exam questions about that. When do we use a straight-through cable? When we actually use a crossover cable is if we're connecting to like devices. So for say example, that exercise people did in Chapter 3, where you were making a little peer-to-peer network. The two hosts are like devices because they're two computers. Okay, and we're now about to talk about the crossover cable. A crossover cable uses both wiring schemes, T56A and T56B, one at each end of the cable. And it simply says here in the notes, which means the order of connections don't match at each end. The cable that we need to connect two devices depends on what the devices actually are. Okay, so we're mapping the transmit pins to the receive pins so that they can talk. Now, we'll tell you this, some of these integrated services routers, if you are using the wrong wire on them, will actually switch themselves, believe it or not. So even though you shouldn't be using a straight-through cable on between your computer and your integrated services router, it'll figure it out and actually switch it for you. Now, who's connected? All right, Kerry's connected. All right, so now, is that making sense about the unlike devices and the like devices, gang?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Very well. Good. Okay. Kim, how are you going on that?
Okay. Actually, I had to take a little leave of absence, so I missed a bit.
Oh, that's all right. Don't worry. We can go through it later. But you know, I was describing to you that day about the crossover cables and the connecting, you know, mapping the pins from the transmit to the receive at one point. Narissa, how are you coping with that?
Yeah, fine. I understand that.
Yep. Sorry, Kim. Did you want to mic up?
Oh, I just said yes. I remember.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good afternoon. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm just up early sandbagging. Disregard me. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Terry.
Well, we will. Well, I'm not going to reiterate all this. It's the repetition here. Okay, some diagram description here, and I'm not going to bore you with it all because it just will not translate into words for me. Okay, what are some of the like devices that might include a crossover cable?
Like a computer.
A switch to a switch.
Yep, computer to a computer, switch to a switch. Hub to hub, yep.
Router to a router.
Yep. What about a switch port to hub port?
No, you'd use a straight through cable.
No, it's okay. No, a crossover cable is used for a like device, as we said with the host. So you're right. It's a crossover cable for a like device, which is a switch port to a hub port, switch to a router, switch to a switch, etc. Because we remember we've got to map our pins, our transmit pins, to our receive pins on the other end of the cable. Someone's got an error here. Somebody's actually looked at the notes. That's good. Yeah, I think I remember that being talked about at the time.
I can remember in your old lecture that you did last year with Jackie, you said there was an alert that there was a mistake in the notes.
Yeah, there is. And somebody's actually annotated it. Oh, did we annotate it? Because somebody's actually written here PC to router port, and they're trying to tout that as a like device, and that's why somebody's written here error with an exclamation mark. I don't know if it was me or Jackie or somebody prior to us. These are Jackie's and my notes, so I would suspect we did. As I've already said, some devices can sense which pins are used for transmit and receive and will adjust accordingly. So your usual integrated services router does that sort of stuff. Okay, UTP cable termination. Okay, as we know, the UTP cables are terminated into a RJ45 connection, and Pat was asking some pertinent questions about this earlier on. The RJ45 connector is considered a male component, which is crimped to the end of the cable. Okay, there are some diagrams around with the male connector being viewed from the front with the metal contacts facing up, where the pin locations are marked from 8 on the left to 1 on the right. The jack is considered the female component and is located in networking devices or wall outlets. And as we know, we plug one into the other. You can purchase cables that are pre-terminated, most of us do. They can be manually terminated on site using a crimping tool, and this is what Kylie's worksheet was all about, because she's the only one who's actually done it other than the people in Perth who were making those recordings several years ago. Okay, when terminating these cables into a connector, untwist only a small amount of wire, and this is done to minimise crosstalk, or as Joel says, crosstalk. Also, when terminating, be sure that the wires are pushed all the way into the connector and that the RJ45 connector is actually crimped onto the wire jacket. This will ensure both good electrical contact and that the connector provides strength to the wire and the connection. So now this is something, it's very, very, very tricky in this environment to teach, because we are remote, so we don't have the laboratory situation that they used to have at the university. Also, it's not really a job that many vision impaired people aim to do. Okay, so you are forgiven, and that's why we sort of relax the rules a bit for this chapter. However, it's handy to know if you're getting into networking how these things work. Any questions before we move on to 4.5.4?
This may confuse matters a little bit, but when they say terminate, that just means it ends at the wall, or is it like a SCSI bus that actually to have a device?
Oh, I see what you mean. No, it just means terminating, as in like ending at the wall, ending it where it physically ends, the plug in your hand.
It is actually electrically terminated. We don't cover that here, but it is actually, there are actually resistors to pull it down.
Yeah, in coax, okay. Yes, that's right. You know, we used to use our terminator there with our 50 ohm coax at the end of the run. I think it's covered here. I'll see if it is. Okay, in the network operation center, network devices are usually connected to patch panels. The uses of patch panels allows the rearranging of equipment within the NOC, etc. So it makes things easy. These patch panels use RJ45 connectors, and you might see this in some of the corporate environments too. I've seen them around desks, around offices too, in different places I've worked in over the years. So it allows people to move things around a bit easier. It says here, patch panels are no longer confined to enterprise organisations. They can be found in many small businesses and homes where we need a central point for telephone, data, and even television. Okay, the RJ45 connector has 8 conductors and is wired to either, as we said before, the T56A and the T568A and the T568B standard. Okay, at the patch panel, and this is what Kylie discussed in her work, a device known as a punch down tool is required to push the wires into the connector. Okay, the wires should be matched up to the appropriate installation displacement and before punching them down. Punch-down tool is not required to terminate most wall jacks. To terminate these types of connectors, the cable is untwisted and placed into the appropriate IDC. Placing the cap under the jack pushes the cable into the IDC and cuts through the insulation on the wires that will make the contact. Most of these connectors require the installer to manually trim away excess cable. Now, in all cases, and this is important, in all cases, untwisting more cable than is required will increase the risk of interference and crosstalk. And this will degrade your network performance. So it's a tricky exercise to get this right, because you might feel the urge to untwist more cable, and then you've changed the way the cable performs. Any questions?
What does a punch-down tool look like?
I've got no idea. That's the disadvantage of the online learning environment. But Kerry, Mike, go ahead, Kerry.
It's basically this thing, it's basically got sharp points on the end of it. It's a bit like a crimper, except the actual points on it that force the things down into place are like really sharp and nasty. So if you look up on the website, there's actually some cable making demos we did in 2007, and we describe all the tools and try not to stick ourselves with the sharp bits. So I would avoid punch down tools if at all possible. I don't tend to touch them. They're a little bit exciting.
When a neural repaired cable is terminated, it is important to verify that the cable operates correctly. Oh, there you go. In other words, don't just throw it in and run off. If you're doing cable installations, make sure it works for the client. You don't want to have to go back. This can be done through a series of tests. Obviously, the first test is a visual inspection. It's a basic test. In addition to visually inspecting your cable, you can use cable testers. Now, most of these are not accessible to vision-impaired people, which is unfortunate. Some of these, let's see what's here in the notes. Okay, let's see. There's a couple of bullet points here. There are cable testers, and some of those cable testing labs that Kerry mentioned do talk about it. There's cable certifiers, and of course the good old traditional multimeter. You can use that for continuity test. Yay. Okay, with the cable tester, we can test for different types of faults, such as wires that are mapping to the wrong pin or shorts or open circuits. Cable tester can be used to perform initial diagnostics. Now, the first test is usually called a continuity test, which we can do with also a multimeter, and that verifies that the circuit the wire has end-to-end connectivity, for example. So we might test pin one on our cable and get to the other end of it and find that we've got continuity because our meter tells us. In other words, if the light globe was connected, it would go on. We can also, as it said before, detect opens and shorts. Now, this is important. I might even be in the test. I think an open circuit is when the wire is broken. So let's say between pin 1 at one end and pin 1 at the other end, the wire's not properly terminated or it's been chopped, and it's an open circuit. This means that there's no electrical circuit, no electrical contact. This could be what's wrong with Kim's speakers. She's got a dicky plug on the speakers we're looking at during the week. It's either shorting against the other side. I think it's probably gone more open circuit, to be honest. And as it says here in the notes, an open can occur if there's a break in the wire. Now, what do you think a short is, gang?
It's if the copper parts touch.
Yep, that's it. In other words, it makes the circuit shorter. So that's why we get the term short circuit, because there is continuity, but it's going in the electricity or the power or the signal's going in the wrong place. It's shorted out. So it says here in the notes, as the electrical signal's going down, it will cross onto another wire and is basically, really an unintended path. Now, these cable testers, depending on the quality and the amount of money you want to spend on them, can test for all of this sort of stuff. Can test for an open circuit, can test for a short circuit, and can test, many different things. Does it by using a wire map. Because sometimes if you have, crossover, one wire inside the connector connected where it should be, then the meter will tell you that too. When this happens, it is necessary to re-terminate the cable. There's a diagram description here that depicts many different wiring types of problems. Okay, this isn't going to translate too well into words. Okay, now, obviously, if something like this goes wrong, you have to re-terminate your cable. So it can get a bit expensive, I guess, if you're having to sort of chuck away bits of ends of cable and redo them. There is the cable certifier. So we've just done all that with the cable tester. Another heading here is the cable certifier. A cable certification tester identifies the precise performance of a cable and then records it in graphical form for the customer record. So it must show you some sort of picture. A multimeter, of course. A multimeter can measure AC or DC voltage and other aspects like ohms and resistance, etc. And other electrical characteristics. So that's what you would use. You'd stick your multimeter on the ohm setting to do your continuity test. Okay, any questions before we move on to cabling best practices? Okay. The following steps, called best practices, ensure that your cables are terminated correctly. All right, well, there's a bit of repetitive stuff here. It's talking about the cables adhere to those two standards I mentioned before. Yep. As we know, modern converged networks carry voice and data. Therefore, the cables on our converged networks must be able to support all these applications of data, voice, and that sort of stuff. So we need to use the right type of cable. We don't want to use a Cat 3 cable where a Cat 6 cable or a Cat 5e cable is required. The standards specify maximum lengths for different types of state cables. UTP, like all copper cable, is susceptible to EMI. There's a tricky question in the exam that I don't like because the English testers have got to it. I think it is absolutely crazy. But it refers to a factory. I think the right answer was the one with the factory in it. because there's another answer that I also would deem correct. That's one of these pick twos. So basically, you know, it's just Cisco playing with semantics, to be blunt, and sort of being counterproductive about the whole thing. Okay, this is important, this bit. It is important to install cable away from interference, which is why I think it comes to mind that question about the factory and all that sort of stuff, or where the, you know, where the interference is in a noisy environment. High voltage and fluorescent lighting, I think, is the answer you're looking for. I haven't got the question in front of me at the moment. But basically, if you think of things like fluorescent lighting, they can cause interference. High voltage, you'll get that question right. Computer monitors, television sets, and microwave ovens are other sources of interference. In some of these environments, it may be important to install cable in conduits. Nerissa. So,
conduits? Can you please explain?
Yeah, all right. Conduits are really just basically pipelines to protect the cable. They can be made out of, you know, perspex. They can be made out of metal, I guess, something with some shielding in it to further shield the cable. Conduit can protect the cables from, you know, heat sources being, you know, being bumped, torn, ripped, etc. So it's just a pipe, really. Just as I said to you the other day, with sometimes people run power cables down conduit if they want to put a, you know, a power outlet on a brick wall or something without trenching the wall.
Yeah, that one tricked me in the exam because I didn't know what conduit was. And I'd read in the notes that it said sometimes cables can lose their or have bad signal if they're bundled together. And I thought maybe that was it.
Yep.
Or bundled together for long distances, it said.
Yeah, well, I can, because if they're bundled together for long distances, you could get interference between them.
So what would bundle them together? Like, I thought maybe they
were all stuck in this thing. Well, let's say, for example, we had a university campus, for example, one building to another. We needed to get a couple of different networks. We needed telephony, some TCP/IP, even some television or something from, you know, one network to another, from one building to another. Somebody's going to run them close together because it's just makes sense to do it, you know. Put one conduit in, I'll put many conduits in, but run them across the same part of the campus, or else you'd have wires strung up all over the joint.
Oh, I didn't quite understand that, what that was talking about.
So, you know, in actual fact, a lot of buildings have an MDF, a main distribution point. I don't think I've seen it mentioned in this course. I saw it mentioned in the Discovery 2 course, and they'll have a mainframe or a main distribution point. And that's where all the telephony, all the network stuff comes through, probably other things, and then it's usually in a cupboard somewhere down the hallway, or somewhere it's a little bit secure anyway, and all the information will come in here. I think once we even referred to it as a mainframe when I was working at Health Computing Services in Collins Street. And all the stuff for that level, all the telephone systems came in through there. These days you would probably find the telephone system would come in there and any networking from other parts, so the main distribution part of it.
Yeah, over here we call them comm closets, because usually telecommunications and networking, not power, you know, not commercial power, come into that room. The power comes in other places because that would really cause interference. That's generally where the patch panels are located and where you go from Ethernet to copper, if you're going from Ethernet to copper. Now, that's how our building is set up at work anyway.
Yeah, it sounds pretty typical. Is that making sense, Nerissa?
Yes, it does. Yes, it sounds very logical. Now I understand.
Yeah, it just means that technicians can go to these one places if, you know, it's, you know, let's say, for example, we were on level 9 of this particular building at Health Computing Services. There are our offices and a couple of other offices down the hallway. So, you know, it all came up to level 9, and then what you would do is you would, you know, some of the telephony would go to our office and some of it would go to the people down the corridor. Structured cable is a method for creating and organising cabling systems that can be easily understood by technicians, network administrators, and any other technicians who deal with cables. One component of structured cabling is cable management. Cable management serves multiple purposes. As I say, we don't want to string up all this horrible black coax over the university campus. If we can run it nicely out of sight somewhere, they might find a few cable runs that are being grouped together. This sort of management provides a neat and organised system which aids in the isolation of cabling problems. By following cable management best practices, the cables are protected from physical damages. Let's not run it across the footpath of the campus. Let's run it underground, or let's run them above ground or something. But let's, you know, make sure these things are safe. You often see risers in high-rise buildings between the levels, where they're running cables between levels, and usually in conduits, that sort of stuff. Another thing you have to be aware of in cable planning, of course, is like anything, what might be sufficient there may not be sufficient in the future. Remember that standards help to ensure that the cables will be able to be delivering acceptable performance. All right, okay, we're not going to repeat this. Why do I have to repeat it so many times? Do they think we don't get it? Good grief. Guess what, gang? We survived it. We're up to the chapter quiz. Good grief. Here ended the official lecture. Okay, gang, any questions?
Not really. I get it, but what I don't understand is why, as a blind person, we expected to know all this stuff.
Okay. In my opinion, you're not, but it's because it's covered in the curriculum. We have to stick as close as we can to the curriculum. We are able to make certain changes, like say, we're not going to expect you to do the punch down labs, for example. But at least knowing about it from the theoretical point of view is better than not knowing about it at all.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going. A theoretical point of view makes sense, but I mean, if we physically, because see, I'm the type of person that doesn't like fooling with cable.
No, and it's because this course is it's horses for courses. I mean, there's aspects about this course that will bore people silly. There's aspects about this course that will get you really excited, and I'm sure you've had those. I'm sure there's bits of this course, Paul, you actually love because you've been here before. And the same can be said for the ITE course too. There's the aspects that people are going to find downright bloody boring. Honestly, they will. And you don't want to know this crap. It's all garbage. But to be honest, it's foundation knowledge that if you have, it will empower you to better survive out in the real world. For example, knowing about this cable boring stuff today might just help you in something down the track. Now, you don't necessarily have to have felt the cable. Although us kinesthetes, as kinesthetic people generally like to do, we like to feel stuff and plug things in and turn things on sort of thing. It is advantageous to do so, but at least knowing about it from a theoretical point of view might empower you in some small way in the future. You just don't see it at the moment.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
The other thing is having, you know, some knowledge of how the actual wiring is put together will help you diagnose a problem. For example, if everything on a floor goes out, it's probably not one wall socket. It's probably something on the patch panel, either at that floor, you know, that further down in the building.
Yeah, I use it all the time. You know, if something goes out, and this is all layer one stuff for those from the other course and those who want to wait until we get there in chapter six, it's all this nice good old Open Systems Interconnect, OSI model stuff, and at layer one we were talking about bits on the wire, and exactly what Marshall just said. If a whole floor goes out, it wouldn't just be one computer or patch panel. It might be the distribution point for that floor. Or if the whole area goes out, you know, we've heard of people here in Australia putting backhoes through communication systems and knocking out whole areas of telephone exchanges. So, you know, if the whole of Mount Waverley goes out, we can ring up and go, oh, well, we've got a problem in Mount Waverley and Chadston that's going to have something to do with the Jordanville telephone exchange, etc. But it won't affect the people down the road at Narissa's house, for example.
Okay, I see what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense now as to why I need this. I really feel comfortable with y'all more than anybody else. Like, I've always...
Oh, thanks, Paul. We appreciate you saying that. Look, I think the other thing about being blind, too, it's easy to dismiss whether it be cables or talking about colours, or talking about anything to do with the sight of the world. Oh, I don't need to know this, I'm blind. Yeah, not a good way to be these days in the modern environment, because there's a lot of things that, if explained to a blind person properly, and Kim will tell you this, can be exciting to learn about, actually.
Well, I would agree with her on that, and that's why I feel that I get a lot. I always look forward to your class regardless.
Thanks, Paul. It's lovely to have the compliment. It's absolutely lovely to hear you say that. Are there any other comments? Kim, how are you going out there?
Pretty well now.
I hope you haven't fallen asleep, do you? It's a bit dry. Yeah, I was hoping to open it up more on ISPs, but to be honest, I think we did probably cover it last week sufficiently. But, you know, we've got half an hour to go. We're finished. I didn't race through this. I took it a bit slower. So if anyone wants to stick around and sort of do a little bit of a chit-chat session regarding the curriculum, any problems they're having, you're welcome to.
Well, I just for a little bit of information, just regarding ISPs and stuff, I have a 16 megabyte connect per second megabit. I think it's either megabytes or megabit per second connection, and I get like 1.44 megabyte per second downloads.
That's right. Yeah, we discussed some of this last week, Paul, when you weren't here. I think we've got another member who's joined the channel too, which is good. I'll have a look who it is in a minute. I think we discussed some of it last week, and that's because of the overheads. And they often say up to a certain speed. So if you've got a 16 megabit connection, yeah, you can theoretically pull down 1.6 megs a second or 1.6 megabytes a second, but you won't really. 1.4 is probably what I would expect to see, you know, off that connection.
Well, then again, I've got like a quad-core processor in my computer. I have one of those quad cores, and that really helps. I was only getting like 200, not even a meg, when I was on my laptop. So this is really good.
I'm glad you got your new computer, but theoretically the processor shouldn't really have a great deal of bearing on how much you can transfer through. Maybe there are other things about that other computer. But yeah, I mean, so I'm glad you got your fast computer. Any other comments from anyone else in the group?
Well, a lot would depend on the traffic on your internet, wouldn't it, Paul? Like, you know, we find, for example, when all the school kids get home, the internet slows down because the traffic increases.
Sorry, what was that, Nerissa?
You know how last week we were talking about that your download and upload speed would be very relevant to the number of users or the amount of traffic on the internet or on the cable? And I was saying that we've noticed that at the time that the school children get home, our speed often goes down appreciably because you've got every kid and his dog on MSN Messenger or Facebook or Twitter or whatever.
Or downloading movies or doing BitTorrent. That's it. Nothing wrong with BitTorrent. There's a lot of legal stuff on it before anyone starts on that hobby horse. I totally agree. As I said to you, and we discussed this last week, just for those of people who weren't here, I haven't caught up with last week's recording, particularly in Nerissa's case, they say, yes, up to 30 megabits per second, up to is the key word, because on the cable system, of course, it's how many other people are on her node, and it can vary from the different time of day. I'll tell you the new person who's come on all the way from the Rock and Roll Club in the other course. How you going, Terry?
Pretty good, thanks. We're shaking around this morning. You're welcome to come over to Christchurch and join the Rock and Roll Club and shake with me in earthquake territory.
No, thank you. I think I'll stay safely in Australia. Thanks, Terry.
Nerissa loves her own rock and roll, and that's the musical version.
Elvis Presley and
stuff. Don't say rock and roll. Thinking about Christchurch is probably a preview for Salt Lake.
Oh, of course.
I hope not.
What, Salt Lake City? We have a thing called the Wasatch runs right through the place. They're guessing a 6-point-something, maybe as high as a 7.5. I'm hoping I'm dead before that happens.
It's, what was I going to say, Terry McElroy is our friend from ITE. She's hasn't had much connectivity due to some problems at the Royal New Zealand Foundation for the Blind. As soon as they got it connected, because they had a firewall issue there, and we'll talk about ports and firewalls at some point, so I think we'll do that in Chapter 6. As soon as she gets connected, the place shook apart, so that put her off air for another week. But she's going to catch us all up, and one day we might even convince her to do Discovery. There you go.
So you won't be teaching anymore.
That's true, yes. Get in now or get in and I'll miss out for good, because I hang up the golden microphone come the end of this course, don't I?
So Terry, you were okay? Were you affected very much?
I was in the foundation not at home when the earthquake struck, and it took us like 2 hours to get home because the roads were all chewed up and we couldn't go through the centre of town, driving through deep water, over cracks and stuff like that. My house has suffered minor damage and we had no power and no water, and today again we've got no water. We had it for a little while, but compared to some people, I'm very lucky and pleased that I could stay in my own home and didn't have to move out and go somewhere else.
Oh, that's lucky, isn't it?
Very much.
Well, now that you're in the network...
There's no water.
That's right, and so I'm off. I've been out getting another water container today and collecting water from a tanker.
Now that you're in the networking class, can I just keep it a little bit on topic and we can discuss some of this
off-channel?
Has it actually... I know, and I don't want to sound certainly in any way unsympathetic, but I'm just considering the people out there in listener land. Has it affected network communications, Terry? Like, you know, internet, I know by knowing you personally, I know you're off the net for a few days, but not just other people you know, but mainstream broadcasting or anything, any network connectivity. How does something as profound as the New Zealand, the Wellington earthquake affect that sort of stuff?
The Christchurch earthquake, this is our second one because we had
Christchurch,
yeah. What happens is the radio stations, we have our a radio network that is kind of talk back and news and that sort of thing, and that's taken over some of the radio stations that normally broadcast music. Some people who still don't have the internet are only, and have had no power for quite a long time, are only reliant on the radio for getting information, and that's a bit frustrating when they keep referring people to websites to find out information. A lot of people here have only got cordless phones which require power to run, so if they had no power they couldn't use the telephone, and those people that had landline phones that plugged into the wall were okay because they didn't require power to actually run the phone. But a lot of networks were overloaded, and you know, people are reliant on radio and TV if they could get access to it to get information.
Of course, and I noticed you yourself were off the internet.
That's right. I have a cable, a broadband connection, and I'm one of these people who will not leave my router plugged in all the time. I turn it off when I'm going out because I don't like it running away with the power that I'm not using. And so my router was not plugged in at the time of the quake, and I couldn't get it going for about a week and a day. For no known reason, although Telstra Clear said it was nothing at their end. It must have been.
Yeah, sometimes it might have had trouble re-authenticating, the equivalent thereof on cable anyway. Had it stayed up, it may have stayed on, yeah. Well, see, this is the thing, these broadband services are, whether it be ADSL or cable, designed to be an always-on service. So had it been on, do you think you would have stayed on the net?
Definitely, because that's the only way I would have had to go to different websites and get, because my power came on the night of after the earthquake, so I was quite lucky there. Some people didn't have it for over a week after the quake. But that's the only way I've got of getting access to information. They were issuing free print newspapers and probably putting signs on lampposts and stuff like that. But, I mean, no good to me because I'm totally blind and don't have anyone in the house that can read me, that sort of thing. So for me, the internet is a lifeline.
Oh, absolutely. What about, have you heard of any infrastructure like with bigger networks between corporate or banks and that sort of stuff being affected by the quake?
For a while, I don't know if you have it in Australia, and I know it's not as widely available in the States. There's a system called EFTPOS, which is electronic fund transfer at point of sale. So use a keypad and...
Yes, we definitely have that here, and they do have something similar in the United States, although they call it something different.
Okay, well, that network went down for a while, but they got that up fairly quickly, and a lot of banks and supermarkets here are... my local supermarket is condemned, so it's going to be another 18 months or so before they get one built. We have some supermarkets affected by fire. Supermarkets and businesses were in a cordoned off area in the central business area where the main damage occurred. So, yeah, a lot of things like that have been affected.
Absolutely.
People can't get access to their business records, their backups, their computers are all down because they've isolated the power in the central city, so it's affecting a lot of businesses and, you know, computer companies, I guess, and different places like that that can't operate because the infrastructure's down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a problem, isn't it? So... from a communications point of view...
Don't let me sidetrack your class.
No. We finished the official curriculum. We actually finished early because I dawdled my way through the chapter last week, and we don't usually do discovery over four, chapter four over four over 2 weeks, but we did because we actually had a lot of discussion on ISPs last week, Terry. And the reason I allowed that to happen was because I think when you have students of this calibre who are likely to go into homes and small businesses to fix up a person's computer, which is what we might have done just 10 years ago on our own, or even 15 years ago. These days, you'll inevitably go into the home and small business to not just fix up the person's computer, but to fix up the internet connection as well, or even to advise a client our customer on what internet connection they should get and how they might even share it out among a couple of different computers. And that's what this course is all about. It's discovery one for home and small businesses. So I took the view, because of my own small business background, to allow the conversation to run a bit more on internet service providers and the different ones you can have. And that's how we started off last week's lesson. So we took a little bit longer than have done in the past to do that, because I think it's important. You know, if you're advising a client, should they get cable? If cable's available, should they get ADSL? If so, what are the ramifications? Is the cable good? Can it speed up, slow down, as Nerissa was talking about? Is ADSL a suitable option, or wireless, et cetera, et cetera? It depends on what services are available. So that's why I facilitated that conversation. And then the rest of the chapter, it all deals with cables, which is this dry boring thing we've just finished. Having you come in at the end of it, Terry, means it was good, you know, just to talk about a real life situation. Sorry, go ahead, Marshall.
One other thing about network is, if you use a network backup service, this is a good reason to pick a network service that's out of your local area. So if, you know, we have a big one here called Mosey that handles backups, but one of the reasons I don't want to use it is I figure it'll get clobbered if we ever get an earthquake. So I'm looking for one that's out of state.
It makes sense, because if you've got to access it remotely anyway, what's it matter whether it's down the road or out of state? Yeah, go ahead, Terry.
Can I jump in here? Absolutely, because I'm surprised that a lot of businesses, someone said that to me about the people not being able to get in and get their files, and I said, well, surely they would have them, you know, have a redundant, a secondary system backing up somewhere out of town or out of Christchurch, out of the central business district.
Yeah, I think so. There was a guy at my business thing selling one of these things a couple of years ago, and he was from Ballarat. And I thought, why the hell is he from Ballarat? And it really occurred to me, well, it's better to have it not so close to home, isn't it? So, although we don't really have to worry about earthquakes here, but you just never know.
I wouldn't make that assumption, Elise. There are earthquake faults everywhere that are undiscovered. One of the biggest earthquakes in the United States occurred back in Missouri back in the 1700s.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we're on a single tectonic plate here in Australia, so I don't know whether that means anything. New Zealand's got a lot of seismic activity, of course, and they're only across the ditch.
Well, a couple of years ago, one night, my husband and I were both on our computers, and the desk shook, and for a minute we both thought that our big dog had sort of bumped the desk, but it was a minor quake.
Yeah, we've had tremors. In actual fact, if that was that one on the Friday night, it was ripper. I rang up Jill and Gary. It was down in the southeast of Melbourne. I was sitting here talking to somebody on the phone, and I felt as if I'd been moved, and I could hear a rumble, and I thought it was a cat coming in through the window.
Now, I remember it was night. I don't know what, you know, day of the week it was.
Yeah,
I can
and there was evidently
the
another one a week
sort of
later.
Vibrated.
Yeah. Yep, and even since I've been moved in here, I remember 5 years ago, I was sitting on the floor watching TV. It's not long after I got here, I think, and I felt as if somebody picked me up and moved me a couple of inches to the left or something on the right or whatever it was. So we can have tremors here. So, yeah, it's all about keeping stuff off-site, keeping your data and stuff protected well off-site. The regrettable thing is, for me, my off-site backup broke. That hard drive finally broke, Nerissa, the one we were pulling apart in the pod about a year or so ago. It's finally now bit the dust completely. Remember I was showing you and Ian that at the dining room table?
I'm not sure which one you mean. You've shown us various things over the time.
Oh, you'll probably know it if you saw it, but yeah, anyway. Any other comments? How are you travelling out there, Pat?
Okay. Is it okay to go ahead and take Chapter 4 test then?
Absolutely. The exams are activated, and there is going to be you've just reminded me on something, there's going to be an outage on the Cisco website, I think for you guys, I'd have to look at the times again, but it's going to be most of Saturday and early Sunday morning for 16 hours. When it comes back up on Sunday your time, you will notice, which is going to be out from about the whole of Sunday for us, evidently, it's going to ask you to accept a new terms and conditions when you log back in for the first time. Now, that's the only report of any interruption to your user experience, but do let us know if this is anything's changed and becoming a challenge to use. How are you travelling, Kim? Good. All right, well, I think it's all. I think unless anyone's got anything further to do, we are ahead of time. We don't have to, you know. I'm not prepared to start chapter five. I'm not feeling the greatest, and chapter five is something that really ought to be done when we're all fresh. So, can I advise people to get your worksheets in though, for those who haven't? I'll mark them all off and take the chapter four quiz. Get over chapter four because it starts to get a bit heavy again next week, which is your chapter five, network addressing.
Oh, yes, and this chapter is where I really cratered.
Well, Paul, come and have a listen. I would certainly advise you, have a listen to the Jackie version of this, Jackie's and my version. Jackie, now, the Cisco curriculum goes into network addressing. I haven't quite decided how I want to lay out next week's lecture, but she took us into the IP stuff a little bit heavier than Cisco does at the beginning, because when you come out of it and it lightens up at the end of the first lecture, of first part of Chapter 5, it all sort of falls into place to make sense. So Chapter 5 will be a two-parter as it was in the last version of this that Jackie and I did. It will get pretty heavy in the first part of it, and then it will taper back off again. I would recommend having a listen to the way Jackie describes it. It is the reason why we call her Magic J. It truly is. She's just absolutely delightful the way she does it. And is it particularly for anyone who's had difficulty understanding some of these concepts in the past, definitely get this chapter down. It's a must-hear chapter.
Paul, can I say that through listening to Jackie and Elise, I finally conquered how binary numbers work, and I just kept listening to that lecture, and it was extremely helpful.
Yes. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say it is the benchmark. I don't know how the others are going. I haven't listened to some of the more recent lectures from the other courses, but I still regard that lecture as the best one I've ever heard. Even though I'm not trying to blow our own trumpet here, but the way Jackie delightfully describes it and takes people through it, I don't think anyone could get on. Got half a mind to ring her up and say, come back and do it again for me.
Have you got that lecture, Paul? Because it really is helpful.
I had that one. I had all that stuff, but I'm going to have to go ahead and download it again. I'm going to have to download all of them, because I think I might just download the whole thing.
Grab the whole thing down, because what I'm also trying to do, Paul, is break. Yeah, in the two-part of chapters, I know Chapter 4 was a bit of an exception, because I'm also contemplating making Chapter 6 a two-part of 2, but definitely for the two-parters, which is Chapter 3 and Chapter 5 of last semester's version of this course, I will break it at the same point, so you can mix and match. If you've listened to half of Chapter, say Chapter 3, or Chapter 5, for example, and you're waiting to, you know, you've attended this, for example, and you're waiting for the next half of it, you get down Jackie's and my version of this course, it'll resume at the same point, so you can go ahead without going, oh, I think I've heard this before, or we seem to have skipped a bit and there's a break in it. So I will get that chapter out and take a note of where she stopped, or where her and I stopped, and I will stop next week's lecture at the same point, irrespective of time. Well, if we go too over time, we won't, obviously, but we won't go over time. But even if we finish early, I will not break it at a different point.
That's good. That's really good to hear.
And that empowers
you to
miss.
I'm under the weather, too.
All right, well, let's knock it off.
I'll send you an email sometime, probably Sunday, and work. If I have any questions about 3 and 4, I'd forgotten about them taking the Cisco site down, so I can't take any exams this week. But I've got enough to study to keep me really busy, and if I have any questions, I'll send you an email.
Oh, you're more than welcome to, Marshall. Absolutely. Send us an email. This course is open until June or July anyway, so you don't have to rush through it as quickly as the lectures have been presented. If you need more time on those chapters, by all means, take it. Look, I think everybody so far who's submitted work and have looked at the scores on the board have done extremely well. It's quite a lot of new concepts there in Chapter 3, so that's where we see the scores drop a bit. But considering that, taking that into account, I think everyone did well to get through, and we can understand that, you know, sometimes people may need a bit of extra time. So, yep, it's a self-paced learning course, so that's fine.
Have a good weekend, everybody.
You too, Marshall.
Nice to talk to you all.
Yes, so welcome aboard, Terry, and you're welcome to pop your head in the door anytime, even though you're only doing the IT course. Pop in. Your contributions will be most welcome. Okay, see you all next week. It's been lovely working with you again. Thanks very much for your time, and we'll be back for Chapter 5, Networking. Bye all.